Chapter 39. He had instincts of wisdom. He felt that this was a serious affair, for it had nothing to do with reason. He did not want to raise an enemy for himself in the mate. And Mr. Franklin did not take offense. To Mr. Powell's truthful statement he answered with equal truth and simplicity, that it was very likely, very likely. With a thing like that next door to witchcraft almost weighing on his mind, the wonder was that he could think of anything else. The poor man must have found in the restlessness of his thoughts the illusion of being engaged in an active contest with some power of evil, for his last words as he went lingeringly down the poop ladder expressed the quaint hope that he would get him, Powell, on our side yet. Mr. Powell, just imagine a straightforward youngster assailed in this fashion on the high seas, answered merely by an embarrassed and uneasy laugh which reflected exactly the state of his innocent soul. The apoplectic mate, already halfway down, went up again 3 steps of the poop ladder. Why, yes. A proper young fellow, the mate expected, wouldn't stand by and see a man, a good sailor and his own skipper, in trouble without taking his part against a couple of shore people who Mr. Powell interrupted him impatiently, asking what was the trouble? What is it you are hinting at? He cried with an inexplicable irritation. I don't like to think of him all alone down there with these two, Franklin whispered impressively. Pon my word I don't. God only knows what may be going on there. Don't laugh. It was bad enough last voyage, when Mrs. Brown had a cabin aft, but now it's worse. It frightens me. I can't sleep sometimes for thinking of him all alone there, shut off from us all. Mrs. Brown was the steward's wife. You must understand that shortly after his visit to the fine cottage with all its consequences, Anthony had got an offer to go to the Western Islands and bring home the cargo of some ship which, damaged in a collision or a stranding, took refuge in St. Michael and was condemned there. Roderick Anthony had connections which would put such paying jobs in his way. So Florida Barrel had but a 5 months' voyage, a mere excursion, for her first trial of sea life. And Anthony, dearly trying to be most attentive, had induced this Mrs. Brown, the wife of his faithful steward, to come along as maid to his bride. But for some reason or other this arrangement was not continued. And the mate, tormented by indefinite alarms and forebodings, regretted it. He regretted that Jane Brown was no longer on board as a sort of representative of Captain Anthony's faithful servants, to watch quietly what went on in that part of the ship this fatal marriage had close to their vigilance. That had been excellent, for she was a dependable woman. Powell did not detect any particular excellence in what seemed a spying employment. But in his simplicity he said that he should have thought Mrs. Anthony would have been glad anyhow to have another woman on board. He was thinking of the white-faced girlish personality which it seemed to him ought to have been cared for. The innocent young man always looked upon the girl as immature, something of a child yet. She. Glad. Why, it was she who had her fired out. She didn't want anybody around the cabin. Mrs. Brown is certain of it. She told her husband so. You ask the steward, and hear what he has to say about it. That's why I don't like it. A capable woman who knew her place. But no. Out she must go. For no fault, mind you. The captain was ashamed to send her away. But that wife of his, I, the precious pair of them have got hold of him. I can't speak to him for a minute on the poop without that thimble rigging coon coming gliding up. I'll tell you what. I overheard once, God knows I didn't try to, only he forgot I was on the other side of the skylight with my sextant. I overheard him, you know how he sits hanging over her chair and talking away without properly opening his mouth. Yes, I caught the word right enough. He was alluding to the captain as the jailer. The jail. ! Franklin broke off with a profane execration. A silence reigned for a long time and the slight, very gentle rolling of the ship slipping before the N.E. trade wind seemed to be a soothing device for lulling to sleep the suspicions of men who trust themselves to the sea. A deep sigh was heard, followed by the mate's voice asking dismally if that was the way one would speak of a man to whom one wished well. No better proof of something wrong was needed. Therefore he hoped, as he vanished at last, that Mr. Powell would be on their side. And this time Mr. Powell did not answer this hope with an embarrassed laugh. That young officer was more and more surprised at the nature of the incongruous revelations coming to him in the surroundings, and in the atmosphere of the open sea. It is difficult for us to understand the extent, the completeness, the comprehensiveness of his inexperience. For us who didn't go to sea out of a small private school at the age of 14 years and 9 months, leaning on his elbow in the mizzen rigging, and so still, that the helmsman over there at the other end of the poop might have, and he probably did, suspect him of being criminally asleep on duty, he tried to get hold of that thing by some side which would fit in with his simple notions of psychology. "What the deuce are they worrying about?" he asked himself in a dazed and contemptuous impatience. But all the same, Mailer was a funny name to give a man. Unkind, unfriendly, nasty. He was sorry that Mr. Smith was guilty in that matter because, the truth must be told, he had been to a certain extent sensible of having been noticed in a quiet manner by the father of Mrs. Anthony. Youth appreciates that sort of recognition which is the subtlest form of flattery age can offer. Mr. Smith seized opportunities to approach him on deck. His remarks were sometimes weird and enigmatical. He was doubtless an eccentric old gent. But from that to calling his son-in-law, whom he never approached on deck, nasty names behind his back was a long step. And Mr. Powell marveled. Dot, while he was telling me all this, Marlowe changed his tone, marveled even more. It was as if misfortune marked its victims on the forehead for the dislike of the crowd. "I am not thinking here of numbers. Two men may behave like a crowd, three certainly will when their emotions are engaged." It was as if the forehead of Flora DeBarrel were marked. Was the girl born to be a victim, to be always disliked and crushed, as if she were too fine for this world? Or too luckless, since that also is often counted as sin? Yes, I marveled more, since I knew more of the girl than Mr. Powell, if only her true name. And more of Captain Anthony, if only the fact that he was the son of a delicate erotic poet of a markedly refined and autocratic temperament. Yes, I knew their joint stories which Mr. Powell did not know. The chapter in it, he was opening to me, the sea chapter, with such new personages as the sentimental and apoplectic chief mate and the morose steward, however astounding to him in its detached condition, was much more so to me as a member of a series, following the chapter outside the Eastern Hotel in which I myself had played my part. In view of her declarations and my sage remarks, it was very unexpected. As he had meant well, and I had certainly meant well too. Captain Anthony, as far as I could gather from Little Fine, had meant well. As far as such lofty words may be applied to the obscure personages of this story, we were all filled with the noblest sentiments and intentions. The sea was there to give them the shelter of its solitude free from the earth's petty suggestions. I could well marvel in myself as to what had happened. I hope that, if he saw it, Mr. Powell forgave me the smile, of which I was guilty at that moment. The light in the cabin of his little cutter was dim. And the smile was dim too. Dim and fleeting. The girl's life had presented itself to me as a tragi-comical adventure, the saddest thing on earth, slipping between frank laughter and unabashed tears. Yes, the saddest facts and the most common, and, being common, perhaps the most worthy of our unreserved pity. The purely human reality is capable of lyrism, but not of abstraction. Nothing will serve for its understanding but the evidence of rational linking up of characters and facts. And beginning with Flora DeBarrel, in the light of my memories I was certain that she at least must have been passive, for that is of necessity the part of women, this waiting on fate which some of them, and not the most intelligent, cover up by the vain appearances of agitation. Flora DeBarrel was not exceptionally intelligent, but she was thoroughly feminine. She would be passive, and that does not mean an inanimate. In the circumstances where the mere fact of being a woman was enough to give her an occult and supreme significance, and she would be enduring, which is the essence of woman's visible, tangible power. Of that I was certain. Had she not endured already? Yet it is so true that the germ of destruction lies in wait for us mortals, even at the very source of our strength, that one may die of too much endurance as well as of too little of it. Such was my train of thought. And I was mindful also of my first view of her toying, or perhaps communing in earnest with the possibilities of a precipice. But I did not ask Mr. Powell anxiously what had happened to Mrs. Anthony in the end. I let him go on in his own way, feeling that no matter what strange facts he would have to disclose, I was certain to know much more of them than he ever did know, or could possibly guess. Marlowe paused for quite a long time. He seemed uncertain, as though he had advanced something beyond my grasp. Purposely I made no sign. "You understand?" he asked. "Perfectly," I said. "You are the expert in the psychological wilderness. This is like one of those redskin stories, where the noble savages carry off a girl, and the honest backwoodsman with his incomparable knowledge, follows the track, and reads the signs of her fate in a footprint here, a broken twig there, a trinket dropped by the way. I have always liked such stories. Go on." Marlowe smiled indulgently at my jesting. "Tea is not exactly a story for boys," he said. "Go on then." "The sign, as you call it, was not very plentiful, but very much to the purpose, and when Mr. Powell heard at a certain moment I felt bound to tell him, when he heard that I had known Mrs. Anthony before her marriage, that, to a certain extent, I was her confidant. For you can't deny that to a certain extent. Well, let us say that I had a look in a young girl, you know, is something like a temple. You pass by and wonder what mysterious rites are going on in there, what prayers, what visions. The privileged men, the lover, the husband, who are given the key of the sanctuary, do not always know how to use it. For myself, without claim, without merit, simply by chance I had been allowed to look through the half-open door and I had seen the saddest possible desecration, the withered brightness of youth. A spirit neither made cringing, nor yet dulled, but as if bewildered in quivering hopelessness by gratuitous cruelty, self-confidence destroyed, and, instead, a resigned recklessness, a mournful callousness, and all this simple, almost naive, before the material and moral difficulties of the situation. The passive anguish of the luckless. I asked myself, wasn't that ill luck exhausted yet? Ill luck, which is like the hate of invisible powers interpreted, made sensible and injurious by the actions of men? Mr. Powell, as you may well imagine, had opened his eyes at my statement. But he was full of his recalled experiences on board the Ferndale, and the strangeness of being mixed up in what went on aboard, simply because his name was also the name of a shipping master, kept him in a state of wonder which made other coincidences, however unlikely, not so very surprising after all. This astonishing occurrence was so present to his mind that he always felt as though he were there under false pretenses. And this feeling was so uncomfortable that it nerved him to break through the awe-inspiring aloofness of his captain. He wanted to make a clean breast of it. I imagine that his youth stood in good stead to Mr. Powell. Oh, yes. Youth is a power. Even Captain Anthony had to take some notice of it, as if it refreshed him to see something untouched, unscarred, unhardened by suffering. Or perhaps the very novelty of that face, on board a ship, where he had seen the same faces for years, attracted his attention. Whether one day he dropped a word to his new second officer, or only looked at him, I don't know, but Mr. Powell seized the opportunity, whatever it was. The captain, who had started and stopped in his everlasting rapid walk, smoothed his brow very soon, heard him to the end, and then laughed a little. "Ah, that's the story. And you felt you must put me right as to this.
Yes, sir.
It doesn't matter how you came on board, said Anthony. And then showing that perhaps he was not so utterly absent from his ship as Franklin supposed.
That's all right. You seem to be getting on very well with everybody, he said in his curt hurried tone, as if talking hurt him, and his eyes already straying over the sea as usual.
Yes, sir. Powell tells me that looking then at the strong face to which that haggard expression was returning, he had the impulse, from some confused friendly feeling, to add, I'm very happy on board here, sir. The quickly returning glance, its steadiness, abashed Mr. Powell, and made him even step back a little. The captain looked as though he had forgotten the meaning of the word.
You what?
Oh yes. Happy. Why not? This was merely muttered. And next moment Anthony was off on his headlong tramp, his eyes turned to the sea away from his ship. A sailor indeed looks generally into the great distances, but in Captain Anthony's case there was, as Powell expressed it, something particular, something purposeful, like the avoidance of pain or temptation. It was very marked once one had become aware of it. Before, one felt only a pronounced strangeness. Not that the Captain Powell was careful to explain, didn't see things as a shipmaster should. The proof of it was that on that very occasion he desired him suddenly, after a period of silent pacing, to have all the staysails sheets eased off, and he was going on with some other remarks on the subject of these staysails, when Mrs. Anthony, followed by her father, emerged from the companion. She established herself in her chair to leeward of the skylight as usual. Thereupon the captain cut short whatever he was going to say, and in a little while went down below. I asked Mr. Powell whether the captain and his wife never conversed on deck. He said no, or at any rate they never exchanged more than a couple of words. There was some constraint between them. For instance, on that very occasion, when Mrs. Anthony came out they did look at each other. The captain's eyes indeed followed her till she sat down. But he did not speak to her, he did not approach her, and afterwards left the deck without turning his head away after this first silent exchange of glances. I asked Mr. Powell, what did he do then, the captain being out of the way? Went over and talked to Mrs. Anthony. I was thinking that it must be very dull for her. She seemed to be such a stranger to the ship. The father was there, of course?
Always, said Powell. He was always there sitting on the skylight, as if he were keeping watch over her. And I think, he added, that he was worrying her. Not that she showed it in any way. Mrs. Anthony was always very quiet, and always ready to look one straight in the face.
Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.